Hello, and welcome to the first ever episode of Nutrition Unlocked, the podcast celebrating innovations advancing the role of nutrition and health, sponsored by Nestle Health Science. I'm your host, Anna Moll, and welcome to a space where we'll discuss topics surrounding nutritional health in today's world, allowing us to better understand the science and how we manage our own health. Each episode will focus on a different subject, and we will be inviting globally recognized experts in their fields to come and share their perspective on some of the most interesting topics in health today. For our first ever episode, we'll be focusing on all things surrounding food allergies. They're on the rise, and it seems that most of us know at least one person with a food allergy. In fact, data suggests that around 7% of the world population has a food allergy. That's more than double the rate from 1960. And it's not just the obvious ones like peanuts. It's what we call the big nine. Tree nuts, milk, egg, soy, wheat, shellfish, finfish, sesame, and peanuts. Allergies to these foods are more common now in both kids and adults. But why? And what can be done for sufferers? I'm delighted to be joined by two very special guests who are experts in this area, Dr. Ruchi Gupta and Dr. Brian Vickery, who will talk to about why food allergies are on the rise, if there is a way to prevent them, and what kinds of scientific advancements we can expect in the coming years. I'm pleased to introduce our first guest on the podcast, Dr. Ruchi Gupta, Professor of Pediatrics and Medicine at Northwestern Medicine and Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago, and founding director of the Center for Food Allergy and Asthma Research. She is also the author of the newly released book, Food Without Fear. We are so excited to have you on the first episode of our podcast, Dr. Gupta. Ruchi, it is really such a privilege and a pleasure to have you join us today. In addition to being a clinical pediatrician and a professor, you've done a lot of research into the prevalence and burden of food allergies. We know that food allergies are increasing, but what does the trend look like?
I have been studying food allergy prevalence, especially in the U.S., for a good 15 years now. And it's fascinating when you look at the trends. Now, we all know it's increasing, right? Because when we were young, you know, you always hear this, we could take peanut butter and jelly sandwiches to school and no worries. And now there's so many restrictions. So something has changed. And what we have found in terms of prevalence numbers, and I'll start with the US and then I'll move on because it is increasing worldwide. In the United States, we have found that about 8% of kids have food allergies, or about two in every classroom. Your symptoms can be drastically different, and food allergies can actually be life-threatening, and they can cause anaphylaxis. You can have trouble breathing and throat closing and cardiovascular symptoms. So getting that awareness out has been one of our missions and so many other foundations and organizations around the world. And I think it has improved. Now we have policies in schools for stock epinephrine, which is incredible. We have policies for trainings, and we have restrictions on foods or safe places for kids to eat. There's a lot more we can do and we need to continue, but we're in a better place right now.
The growing prevalence of adults also having allergies. Is that because there are more children having allergies and they continue to grow up with them? They don't grow out of them? Or are more adults starting to get allergies as they get older?
So both. So first, a lot of the foods, especially peanuts, tree nuts, shellfish, and finfish, kids don't typically grow out of or develop natural tolerance to. It's a smaller percentage. It's 10 to 20. Milk and egg, kids do grow out of, but we have seen them sticking around longer. But I'd say at least half of them will develop natural tolerance, so grow out of them themselves and be able to eat it by the time they're adults. We're seeing so many kids now going to college, being independent, wanting to have fun and socialize and go to parties and not want to say, hey, what's in this? And it's so critical at that time point when they're becoming independent to give them that safety net, that education and awareness around them. We do see a lot of these kids growing up and becoming adults and continuing their food allergies. But what was so fascinating was that half of the adults who were in our study said they developed a new food allergy as an adult.
Wow.
So a brand new food allergy. And the number one for adults is actually shellfish. So peanut and then milk, but shellfish is off the chart. So we hear this all the time. People could eat it just fine and now they can't. So it's fascinating. So we don't know what's going on. And this is the next layer of research that's being done is what is it what turned on that switch in the adult? You know, what triggered this food allergy to start when they've already, you know, have never had it and have been able to eat that food just fine?
Yeah, it's fascinating and a little scary all at the same time, but it's an exciting next frontier to understand. What are some of the hypotheses on why more kids have food allergies than we've seen in the past?
Yeah, this is such a critical question that we're all trying to figure out. And some of the main things that you hear about, I'd say, are this whole idea of hygiene and us not playing in the dirt and being too clean, and are our bodies attacking things that they shouldn't because, you know, they're not being exposed. So that has become a big push, and that kind of leads into the microbiome. So the microbiome is something that so many of us are studying to better understand what is it, what kind of gut microbiome do we need to stay healthy in general, but especially for food allergies, and what disrupts that? And some disruptors, you know, that get talked about a lot are, what have we done as a society in the last generation? What's changed? So you look at things like increased C-section, so babies aren't getting exposed to mother's bacteria. You think about antibiotics. We did increase the amount of antibiotics that mothers and kids were getting that early stage of life. And how does that disrupt the good bacteria along with the bad? So there's a lot of work being done in that space to better understand it. And so as that moves forward, I think we'll have more answers. The third big area is our food supply. How have we changed how we eat in a generation? So much is in there, how we grow our foods, what pesticides we use, what preservatives. A lot has changed. So those are three of the biggest theories right now in terms of why we've seen this increase. Now in infants, what's really exciting is we understand now when this food allergy epidemic almost was increasing and starting at its peak around 2000, the American Academy of Pediatrics actually made it a recommendation that we delay peanut introduction till age 3. And their reasoning is probably because something's going on and we don't know what it is. What happened was not a lot of research was done until the LEAP study in 2015. And then the recommendations pretty much flipped. We learned, oh no, we should not be avoiding it. We should be introducing it into an infant's diet early to prevent food allergies. Now we're pushing so hard to get the food into the diet, to have the immune system be able to recognize it, to actually prevent that food allergy from developing.
It's really interesting how the recommendations can change so dramatically, certainly for grandparents who raised their children who are now having kids a certain way. They're saying, do this or don't do that. And the children are like, what are you talking about? But there's probably also some confusion when parents are having multiple children. Suddenly the recommendation changes. How do you, first of all, educate parents who are caught in that cycle? And then how do you get people comfortable with, in some cases, a very dramatic change in the recommendation?
That is what we are working so hard to do. I know how hard it is for pediatricians at those 4 and 6 month visits to get everything in. And how do you encourage this? This is our biggest issue in research. You publish something, but how do you get it to people who need it? We identify places where parents go. We know some of the websites and centers and things that they follow. And trying to get this information into their materials is really important. Also, a big focus of mine is the underserved community, right? You know, there's only a certain amount of people who are savvy and are on these websites and looking through all of it, but getting it to the underserved community where they don't maybe have those resources, how do we make sure everybody gets this information?
You know, you mentioned before the importance of diversity of diet and not wanting to take foods out of children or adults' diet. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of that? Why is it important to have a diversity of diet and avoid removing foods? Because it could seem like an easy solution. Well, I'm a little nervous about this food. I just won't have it.
In generations past, whatever you were eating, whatever was cooked at the dinner table, you just smushed it up either in your own mouth and then fed it to the baby or in a blender. And they would have all kinds of flavors and tastes and be introduced to this diversity early. Somehow we got away from that. We got to one food at a time every 3 to 5 days. And if you think about that, and if you really do start around 6 months, which is one of the recommendations too, then how much food are you going to get into that baby before they turn one? And why are we being so restrictive? It's not because of food allergies, because not many people have serious reactions to applesauce or bananas or peas or a lot of the early foods. So that's one thing. I mean, I think we're trying to get away from that medicalization introduce a food a day, you know, and enjoy it and let your baby have fun with it and enjoy the textures and flavors. And that whole medicalization aspect, we got to let go of. Even in the adult population, we need diverse, colorful plates and healthy, nutritious foods. And the more we remove from our diet, not only is your life harder, your quality of life goes down, but it could be detrimental from a nutrition standpoint. You know, so I recently published a book called Food Without Fear, and that was the entire goal of it, is understand what you have. Because what we're seeing is, although 1 in 5 adults have a food condition, only 1 in 20 are getting it diagnosed. So if you eat a food, have a negative reaction, what do? You just stop eating the food. You don't think, I'm going to go to my doctor and get a diagnosis, or I need to get some medication. So I think that's our challenge. So having people better understand what they have, how to manage it, and whether it's even treatable is so critical. I highly encourage people to better understand their symptoms and what is going on in their body, and then get to a doctor, get to an allergist, and really know, so that you can live a better life with more food freedom.
No, that's great. You know, you're not only a very well-regarded expert in this field, but you're also the parent of a child with a peanut allergy. And you discovered that your daughter had a peanut allergy when she was 3. I'd love to hear a little bit about how your being an expert in this field influenced your parenting, and how, as a parent of a child with a peanut allergy, that has influenced your patient care.
Yeah, it has changed everything. I started in this field, and then 3 years into studying food allergies, I found out she had a food allergy. And she was actually playing with my son, who was eating a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and she broke out in hives and vomited. And it was so interesting, because every time you witness a reaction, your heart beats faster and you're scared, right? And so what I've learned through being part of the community is just all the knowledge, all the information, but in the end, it's your child. And how do we empower parents to know that it's okay to be scared, but know what to do next? And, you know, I learned this, you know, through trials and tribulations too, and I learned from other parents. So, you know, what I think it's done for me is it's opened a lot of research ideas, because as I see things, I'm like, wait, there's a hole. Why don't we know more about this? And one of my favorite things to do is talk to families, because I feel just as much a part of them as I do a part of the medical community. It's a special place. I wouldn't obviously have wished it, but now that it's a part of my life, it has really educated me in ways I could never have known without being a part of it every single day.
It's really incredible. It's really a case of walking in your patient's shoes, essentially, and being able to understand on a more personal level what they're going through. I'm sure they appreciate both the scientific and the thoughtful advice that you give them.
And along with that, and for anyone listening, you know, send us your ideas. Show me where the holes are. Every time I go to a meeting, I feel like I learn more from them, because they are the ones on the front lines living it every day. And I think that's very special. So bring them on.
That's a great invitation, right? It's the gift of feedback. How do we learn from people who are actually experiencing it? So what's the one thing you'd like to tell parents of a child with a food allergy?
You know, one thing I always like to end with is, when we surveyed teens and young adults and asked them, did anything good come out of your food allergy? What they told us is, one, they're better advocates for themselves and others. So they feel like they can stand up for themselves and advocate. And then two, they're more empathetic. They understand what other people are going through or other conditions they may have. And three, they're healthier eaters, because they know everything in their food. So I always joke that if you could pick a couple qualities you want in your kids, those are three of the top ones. What's great is, hopefully on the prevention side, we're making strides, and even on the treatment side.
That's incredible. I love your message about empowerment, and it's inspiring to hear how the parents and these kids are handling this and how it helps them learn and grow and really shapes who they are. And you must be really proud to be part of that, playing a role in helping people understand what's happening, why it's happening. How do we work towards treatment? How do we work towards prevention? How do we work towards living with some of these allergies that can be very challenging?
No, I mean, honestly, I'm just honored to be able to do it. You know, who finds a career that impacts their own world so much and can support others? I feel very lucky. I appreciate you doing this with me and getting the word out, because there is so much we still need to educate on.
Dr. Gupta, Thank you so much for your time and for all of your insights into why food allergies are on the rise and the resources available for parents. I really appreciate what you're doing to help the medical community better understand the problem and to help patients through it. Dr. Gupta mentioned that there are resources available online. Those are at the website for the Center for Food Allergy and Asthma Research, of which Dr. Gupta is the founding director. Next, I'm excited to introduce you to our second and final guest today, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at Emory University and founding director of the Food Allergy Center at Children's Healthcare of Atlanta, Dr. Brian Vickery. Dr. Vickery, it is so great to have you on our show. I'd love to start our conversation by hearing a little about yourself and then hearing how your journey in medicine led you to specialize in the important area of food allergies.
It's just a pleasure to be with you. I'm a pediatric allergist immunologist here at Emory University and Children's Healthcare. I focus on food allergies and in particular, a better understanding of food allergies and hope for the development of new treatments. So I do a lot of clinical research, mostly in clinical trials, and then also see patients 2 days a week. I knew I was going to be a pediatrician from the first day I did my pediatric rotation as a medical student. It just became totally obvious to me that I wanted to spend my life working with kids. I pretty quickly figured out I wanted to specialize. There was this huge epidemic of allergic disease because every other kid in my clinic had eczema or asthma or food allergy. The epidemiology of allergic disease shows that there's this disproportionate burden in inner city populations. And that got me thinking, why is that? Why are these diseases so common in kids that live in the city? And so I would read about it and I got fascinated by how the immune system works, how it goes wrong, and really how little we understand about why all that happens. These are sort of modern diseases that historically have not given people a lot of trouble, but now are almost epidemic in terms of their prevalence, and really for which we had very few treatments to offer patients, at least in terms of food allergy. So one day I just was like, well, I guess this is how you pick a field. Maybe it picked me.
That is amazing. And I can hear the passion in your voice. You mentioned that you're involved not only in treating patients with food allergies, but you're also looking at the future of this field. So we'd love to hear about that. But before we look at the future, let's ground ourselves and talk a little bit about what's happening now. What is the current standard of care for someone with food allergies?
That's a good place to start. Yeah. So the standard of care currently for a lot of patients is still reliance on, you know, dietary management, strict avoidance, and then treating any exposures that may happen with rescue medications like antihistamines or auto-injectable epinephrine. So really, it's, you know, be careful, avoid the food. If anything happens, take these medications and get yourself to the emergency room. Not a particularly good standard of care. And so this is relating back to my journey. I got tired of saying this to patients. This is not very good medical care. And it obviously creates a lot of burdens for patients. Avoidance is extremely hard. You say, well, what's the big deal? Just don't eat the food. Well, it actually turns out that allergic patients are exquisitely sensitive to usually small amounts of allergens. So for peanut allergy, on average, a child is going to react to about one-third of one peanut, very small amounts that are hard to avoid. So this creates a lot of stress and worry and precautions that the family takes that are all geared around keeping that child safe. This is still the standard of care for most patients. And so there was a renewed interest on this concept of oral immunotherapy, or what I'll call OIT. Some practitioners began to experiment with the concept of OIT, thinking maybe oral exposure would be safer than injectable exposure. And so the idea here is that you gradually escalate small oral exposures to the allergen under supervision, and these initial starting doses are extremely low. So this was the technique that is familiar to allergists, but had not been widely studied in food allergy. Starting in the mid-2000s, there were some early studies showing that OIT was a feasible approach, that it changes the immune system and it over time can make the individual less sensitive to the allergen, which is a change that we call desensitization. And so, you know, following these early proof of concept studies, more and more groups around the world began to also study OIT, and the effects were largely reproducible. And so that sort of gave momentum to the idea, to the approach. Now, there are some safety concerns with OIT. The treatment involves exposure to allergen, after all. Most patients have some adverse events. although they tend to be mild or moderate and usually tolerable. But anaphylaxis can occur to the treatment, as well as an important set of gastrointestinal symptoms. And these symptoms may overlap with eosinophilic esophagitis, which is an important allergic disease of the GI tract. And this remains poorly understood. It's important to remember that it's not a cure for food allergies and it must be taken every day. But at this point, now thousands of patients around the world have been treated with OIT and frequently find it to be a life-changing experience.
Wow. OIT was first mentioned in 1908, and now so many years later, it was resurrected and now is potentially leading us in a different direction. It's pretty interesting, and I'm sure it's very thought-provoking for parents. And I would imagine that this is a topic of conversation in some of the parent groups of kids with allergies and peanut allergies in particular, because it has such a big impact on the family. Brian, when you were talking before and first introduced the topic of oral immunotherapy, I was thinking about how an allergic reaction, if I understand it correctly, is also a reaction of the immune system. And I was curious about how much research or greater understanding is there of the underlying biology of the immune system of patients and what kind of therapy would work for them? Is there a way that you can understand based on the patient's immune system and how they react, whether they would react well to OIT and whether it would be a possible treatment for them?
That's a really insightful question. I think to take the first part, it's important for listeners, everyone to remember, you know, allergic responses are immune responses by definition. So sometimes people will say, I'm allergic to this food or that food, and they may not be. What they may be describing is an intolerance or an aversion or something else. But when we talk about allergies, they are immune reactions that involve inflammation. And we are just now starting to understand the fundamental biology of where that inflammation comes from, how it propagates through the body and ultimately results in allergic reactions. It's been a challenge because we're talking about food allergy here, which originates in the GI tract, right? And it's hard to study the cells and tissues and molecules in the human GI tract. We can study the blood cells a little bit, but it's hard to see exactly what's going on. So I think we are just starting to scratch the surface of the underlying biology. And there's been, you know, a lot of advancement in the last, I'd say, 5 or 10 years.
Yeah, and I think what's exciting is not only when I listen to how you describe it and the advances that have been made and what we're able to study now, it makes me think about where are we going to be 5, 10, 15 years down the road? What can we expect from the research? What kinds of solutions are you thinking about or are in early exploration for patients?
When we look ahead 5, 10 years down the road, I would put the potential advancements in broadly four categories. The first would be the use of biologic medicines. The second would be re-engineering allergens, what I might call next generation immunotherapy. So when we administer allergens to patients like we do in OIT or with allergy shots, it's to influence the immune response. And typically that is just the regular allergen itself unmodified. But I think, you know, there's through biochemistry and recombinant engineering, even now peptides, there is a sort of a higher tech approach to re-engineering allergens to make them safer or more effective. The third, I would say, is the exploring ways to potentially manipulate the microbials in the GI tract, what we call the microbiome. So each one of us has trillions of bacteria in our gut, and we know from studies that those bacteria very much influence the immune response and are probably very relevant to food allergy. And then lastly, I think whatever the approach, OIT, microbiome, biologics, and so on, over the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to be moving towards more of a personalized medicine approach. So understanding who has what condition, what are those underlying clinical characteristics, what are the biological profiles, the concept of phenotype or endophenotype, where asthma and oncology and some other fields live, so that we have a better sense of picking the right treatment for the right patient at the right time.
I think this whole area that you're describing around personalization is both exciting and fascinating. To think that you can really kind of understand the specific composition of somebody's body and genes and genotype and phenotype and use that to develop a very specific and personalized treatment is incredible. how are you looking at the microbiome in terms of kind of future treatments and future potential?
Yeah, it's captured everyday attention for a number of health states and certainly allergy. So I think there's a huge body that clearly implicates the gut microbiome in allergic disease and in particular food allergy. Now, we're still trying to understand specifically how it works. It appears that the composition is really important, and if the wrong bugs are there, this can affect the way the gut handles allergen and can create an inflammatory state rather than a healthy state. But I think, you know, we are learning more and more about this with the molecular methods that are now available to identify all the specific bacteria.
So we've talked about your journey and your passion for food allergies and helping patients and unraveling this mystery. We've talked about some of the research that's being done, some of the new changes in thinking and about where the future is going. What's the most exciting thing that you can imagine realistically happening in the next 10 years?
I think that there's enough late stage development going on right now with a very deep pipeline that it's very likely that within the next 10 years, we will have multiple treatments available for patients in clinic, including the treatments for the 30 to 40% of food allergy patients who have multiple food allergies. I think that's probably, you know, likely. That's going to be, of course, if the data support it. But there are a number of programs which are probably most likely to enter clinic first. I don't even consider that the most exciting thing, and it's going to be a big deal for patients. You know, I take the nature of your question to be sort of like a blue sky. What could really happen? And I think, I'm speculating here, but I think it's possible or even likely within the next decade that we could isolate and be able to target the mechanisms that create the persistence of IgE responses. So IgE is the antibody that causes allergic reactions, that causes anaphylaxis, and IgE persists in patients with nut allergies and seafood allergies and some others, whereas it tends to go away naturally in patients with milk or egg allergy. And if we are able to do that, if we're able to isolate and target these mechanisms, then we should be able to test how we can start to suppress them or even reverse the production of these antibodies. And so this would start to look like being able to fundamentally reprogram or you could say maybe reboot the parts of the immune system that produce IgE. So I'm not sure that this would yield a clinical treatment to be able to do this within 10 years because development does take a long time. But I could see us making those fundamental insights within the next 10 years and starting to work on really fundamentally reprogramming the immune system.
That would be incredible. That would be something really exciting to look forward to. So maybe one last question, Brian. What's the one thing you'd like to tell parents of a child with food allergy, with everything that you've seen and all of your experience and your positive outlook on the future?
Well, first of all, you're not alone. There are lots of families out there that are struggling, and I would encourage folks to reach out and connect for support. And we increasingly appreciate the sort of the psychosocial burdens, and I would encourage them to seek support because it's hard. But I would also tell them, hang in there. Hope is on the way. What we've talked about so far today is that there's a ton of really exciting research in the pipeline. This is a very exciting time to be in the field. We're really at an inflection point where, again, the only thing we've really been able to do is be careful. Here's your auto injector. Use epinephrine and go to the hospital if something happens. And now we're starting to be able to treat it. There are more treatments that are in that pipeline. When I see patients who have a young child, a newly diagnosed baby or toddler, I try to reassure them, by the time your child's in elementary school, we'll likely have a treatment available for you, maybe even multiple choices. And that could potentially even include, again, that multiple food allergy patient or the hard to treat allergy. I think if we have this conversation on a podcast 5 years from now, it's a totally different conversation. And I think that's why I get up in the morning and do what I do. I think the field is changing rapidly, and I try to convey that to patients so that they know there's a brighter day ahead.
This has been just such an interesting and insightful discussion. I really appreciate your sharing all your experience with us, your outlook for the future, your positivity, and your great passion for food allergy and finding a treatment and hopefully a cure and better prevention someday. So thanks so much for joining us. And thank you for all your incredible contributions.
Well, thank you for your kind feedback there. It's been a pleasure. I really appreciate the opportunity to be on with you and to share with folks the cool things that are happening in the field.
Thank you so much for joining our first episode of Nutrition Unlocked. a podcast sponsored by Nestle Health Science. We hope you enjoyed today's discussion on food allergies as much as we did, and that you discovered something new. If you haven't already done so, please rate, review, and subscribe to Nutrition Unlocked, which is available on all mainstreaming platforms, so you don't miss a single episode and you can let others know about the podcast as well. We look forward to sharing insights on other interesting topics around the science of nutrition with you very soon. We look forward to seeing you next time on Nutrition Unlocked.